Democracy is Power, Rebuilding Unions from the Bottom Up, Chapter 3. Inclusion and Equality, Keys to Democracy. If union democracy is rule of the people within the union, then it needs to include all the people. We've talked about many kinds of obstacles to democracy and participation. Now let's discuss the ones that many people find it difficult to talk about. Racial and gender barriers. These are barriers that exclude people because of prejudice or because of institutions of discrimination. Racism exists within unions just as it does within society. Most white union members don't like to think of themselves as prejudiced, yet it's difficult not to carry some unconscious baggage in society, in a society so long marked by inequality and the need to rationalize that inequality. The competition for jobs feeds into fear, prejudice, and resentment. At the personal level, it may be hard for whites or men to understand the pain inflicted by a casual remark with racial or sexist overtones. But even such incidents undermine union solidarity. In fighting for union democracy, we have no choice but to take on these fears and hidden prejudices. The alternative to racism or sexism has always been to demonstrate that the power of working people of the union lies in the mobilization of members on a democratic, inclusive, and equal basis. In the context of struggle for a better life, people change. Unions are among the most racially diverse institutions in America's racially divided society. They are more integrated than most schools or neighborhoods, more racially diverse than most churches. African Americans are 15% of union members compared to 11% of the employed workforce. Latinos make up another 9%, slightly less than their share of the employed workforce. But the fastest growing ethnic group is in the unions. Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are 3.6% of the workforce and 3.3% of union members. Exclude all these people of color and organized labor would lose a quarter of its membership. That may sound absurd, but time was when many unions did exclude blacks, Latinos, and Asians. Even more recently, the unions that admitted people of color did so on an unequal basis in separate or Jim Crow locals. Union practices that exclude people of color from skilled jobs are still common today. The problems of racism and sexism, prejudice and discrimination have not disappeared. They affect all of us in one way or another. They definitely affect union politics and union power. These barriers can deprive unions of the talents of millions of potentially active members and leaders if they are not tackled. There's a box here that says percentage of the workforce in unions, 1997. It's still helpful, I think, even though it's over 25 years old, or almost 25 years old. Okay. All workers percentage in unions, 14.1%. Percentage of blacks in unions, 17.9%, quite a bit higher than the average. Whites in unions, 13.6%, lower. Latinos, 11.8%. Asian Americans, 12.6%. Men, 16.3%, women 11.6%, black men 20.2%, with the average at 14%, black men 20.2% in unions, black women 16%, white men 16%, white women 10%, Latino men 12.6%, Latina women 10.6%, Asian men 12.8%, Asian women 12.4%. Women too face barriers to participation due to discrimination and the double shift, work on the job followed by housework and childcare at home. Women now make up 40% of all union members, a fraction that is rising. This is somewhat less than women's 46% of the workforce, but a big increase since the 1970s, when women were only 25% or less of union members. While women make up large portions of traditional female jobs like teaching, healthcare, and retail, they are found throughout the workforce. Women workers now make up a substantial portion of better unionized industries, 46% in telecommunications, 40% in non-durable manufacturing, 33% in urban transit, 27% in durable manufacturing. Durable goods are those ones that are expected to last at least 3 years. In 1987, two-thirds of all union members were white males. Today, they are just half. Those who still think of unions as pale, male, and stale just haven't been paying attention. Or rather, they have been looking only at the top leadership, which is still overwhelmingly white and male, a problem today's reform movements must address. It's not enough to recognize or even celebrate diversity in the ranks, however. These days, even corporations have diversity or racial and gender sensitivity training programs. The ideas of these programs is to make people get along at work, not to promote equality or inclusion. Much of today's corporate concern with diversity is simply hypocrisy and has been imposed by law or court actions. It was employers who set discriminatory hiring and promotion policies in far more cases than the unions. Nevertheless, the existence of these programs does underline the failure of many unions to deal well with racial and gender inequality on the job and in the union. Unionism and discrimination. Workplace discrimination on the basis of race or gender goes back generations and rests on ideas and prejudices that often go unexamined. At one time, for example, it seemed natural that there were no women coal miners or construction workers. Today, there are. But women still face an uphill fight to establish their rights because old ideas cast women as too tender for these jobs, even though they have proved they can do them as well as men. Similarly, following the Civil War and Reconstruction, African Americans were driven out of many skilled jobs they had previously performed, as craft unions attempted to protect their white members from the labor market competition. To justify this, craft union leaders and members resorted to arguments that black craftsmen were not and could not be qualified. The old ideas of racial inferiority that had been used to justify slavery were given a new life to justify job discrimination. Thanks to both the many struggles of black and Latino workers over the years and the more progressive racial policies of some unions, particularly in the 1940s, modern unions no longer exclude people on the basis of race or gender. Many unions, however, have preserved more subtle forms of job protection based on discrimination. For example, until a reform movement took over the Pennsylvania Federation of the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way employees in the 1980s, unskilled workers had no way to bid into training for skilled jobs. Here, the heritage of the last century lived on. The rule was not technically based on race, since many of the unskilled workers were white, but it wasn't illegal. Yet, almost all the African Americans fell in the unskilled category due to past discrimination. When a reform movement took over the union, new officers negotiated a system that opened skilled jobs by seniority, both to unskilled blacks and to the many unskilled whites previously barred as well. The result was a more democratic, united union. This story is the exception. All too often, most unions ignore such legal or even illegal discrimination. For decades, African Americans, Latinos, Asians, and women have had to go to court and to the streets to challenge discriminatory practices. With some exceptions, like the United Packing House Workers, now part of the United Food and Commercial Workers, the unions did little. Typically, union leaders would blame such inaction on the prejudice of white or male members, even arguing that it would be undemocratic to go against the wishes of the majority or to violate local autonomy. This reasoning assumes a false idea of democracy. As we argue elsewhere, the jobs of leaders The job of leaders is not simply to reflect the current views of the membership, but to point to the most effective ways to advance the interests of all members and indeed of working people generally. In other words, to lead by persuasion and example. What's behind the conservative approach? Part of the reason is that dealing with institutional racism, the results of historic discrimination, is extremely difficult. Even the best union leaders are overwhelmed with the tasks they face. The path of least resistance may seem to be ignoring backward ideas among the ranks or discrimination on the job, or to opt for tokenism that does not challenge any established relations. This tendency is multiplied many times by the dynamics of bureaucracy and business unionism. Bureaucracies protect themselves first, last, and always. If entrenched leaders see political risks in fighting discrimination, they will avoid it just as they avoid other confrontations when possible. This behavior is backed by business union ideology, which emphasizes normal contract administration, stable bargaining relationships with employers, and a passive membership. Civil rights and social equality are matters best left to legislation, according to this view. Thus, we often see the contradictory phenomenon of unions that support civil rights legislation but ignore discrimination by the employers or within the union itself. Discrimination is a source of disunity and weakness long tolerated or promoted by business unionism. Union reformers need to fight this aspect of business unionism just as they do any other. Aside from the fact that hypocrisy is never a good foundation on which to base an organization, ignoring discrimination or leaving it to some other agency runs afoul of basic trade union principles. Equal pay for equal work, seniority as opposed to favoritism, equal access to grievance and other procedures, one member, one vote, all of these are the basis of equality and solidarity that allow a union to make gains. After all, the notion of taking labor out of competition is the economic basis of unionism. The union sets a pattern on pay, benefits, conditions, so employers can't whipsaw one set of workers against another, thus ratchet wages down. Where inequality is allowed to exist, workers are set up to compete amongst each other. When competition exists, the only direction for wages and conditions is down. Legislation can help tame that competition, but ultimately it is the union that must enforce standards, whether it is civil rights or health and safety legislation or the union contract. In the past, unions have sometimes taken labor out of competition by exclusion. This was the practice of many building trades unions at the very birth of business unionism over 100 years ago. These unions were able to exclude certain workers and thus maintain a monopoly over the labor markets they had organized. Payoff for these skilled workers was substantial. Because of the racism that pervaded society, race became one obvious and easy basis for exclusion. This system of racial exclusion rested on three premises. First and easiest was the agreement of the employers, who were generally no less racist than their workers. The second was the limited nature of the labor markets involved. In those days, both the construction industry and the contractors were small firms, were local and within the reach of the union. The third was a social consensus among the white population, including most employers, that supported formal segregation even when it was not as extensive or underwritten by law as in the South. Except possibly for the first premise, the conditions on which racial labor monopoly rested have eroded. The rise of national and even international construction firms, the differentiation of construction projects and markets, that is, high-rise buildings, mammoth public projects, tract housing, combined with urban sprawl, ended monopoly conditions for the building trades. The consensus that upheld segregation, North and South, legal and unwritten, began to unravel in the era of the Civil Rights Movement. Under these conditions, craft unions could no longer maintain a labor market monopoly for their members. The craft unions, however, did not abandon their exclusionary policies or did so only marginally. The result is clear. The union share of construction in the United States fell from 87% in the 1950s to less than 20% in 1997. The racial exclusion that paid off when the U.S. was still a patchwork of local construction markets and small contractors could not protect white workers in the area. Oh, and small contractors could not protect white workers in the era of multinational corporations, market differentiation, and urban sprawl and globalization. There's a box showing African Americans in skilled occupations. 1983, 1996. Construction 7.1%, 83, 7.9%, 96. Precision production 7.3, 9% in 96. Telephone installation 7.8 in 83, 11.9 in 96. Aircraft mechanic 4.0 in 83, 11.3 in 96. Data equipment repair 6.1 in 83, 9.9 in 96. Percent of U.S. population 11.9%, 83, 12.6 in 96. Okay. Discrimination in in skilled trades jobs is still the norm, despite economic changes, mass movements, new laws, and countless court challenges. As the chart shows, African Americans have made some gains in skilled occupations, yet progress is slow and inadequate. Nor is there much doubt that most union leaderships remain complicit in practices that shelter skilled jobs for whites. Unlike the racial monopoly of yesterday, however, these forms of discrimination no longer manage to take labor out of competition, even where they exclude all but a few women or people of color. The railroad machinist or engineer, the construction worker, or the tool and die maker in an auto plant are no safer from competitive pressures of today's wide-open, deunionized worldwide economy because of the majority of their co-workers are white. They certainly benefit from having these better jobs, which would tend to be relatively better paid no matter who held them, but their wages, benefits, and conditions are threatened in the same way as their less skilled fellow workers. The relative scarcity of their skills provides some shelter and income advantage, but the fact is that skilled blue-collar workers, too, are seeing their conditions erode. From 1980 through 1996, construction workers saw their real hourly earnings drop by 16.5%, compared to only 5% for manufacturing workers. The wage advantage of its construction workers over those in manufacturing declined from 37% to 21%. The strategy of exclusion cannot address these economic forces. All discrimination can do is undermine the trust between white skilled workers and less skilled workers of color in the same industry. If we are right in assuming that the main reason union activists want a more democratic union is that they want to be a more effective union, then questions of racial and gender equality become basic to union reform and democracy. There are a million human reasons people fight for equality, as so many have again and again, and million moral reasons everyone should support them. For the union and its members, however, the underlying reason is that without inclusion and equality, the economic basis of unionism falls apart and solidarity inevitably crumbles. Our ability to fight effectively is undermined. When it comes to a strike, almost everyone understands this simple point. When it comes to internal union affairs or day-to-day workplace life, however, it's often lost sight of by a complacent white majority and borne silently in angry frustration by those who feel the reality of racism or sexism. How unions affect inequality. Well, there's a box here. I'll go to the box first. Racism, win-lose or lose-lose. Racial wage gaps and unequal employment patterns continue to be the rule. Whites clearly get the better deal. This gives them an economic incentive to hang on to the old ways of discrimination. But does this really pay? In relative terms, yes. The gap in wages between white males and black males widened from 24% in 79 to 32% in 1997, as the real wages of African American men plunged some 9.5%. But the growing racial wage gap didn't buy the average white male wage earner a thing. His real hourly wage dropped by 3.4%. The drop in everyone's real wages is partly due to employer aggression. In the era of concessions and union decline, the average annual wage increase in major collective bargaining agreements dropped from almost 10% in 1980 to 2.4% in 1995. Another reason is the society-wide loss of unionized industrial jobs and the replacement by lower-paid non-union jobs of all kinds. In both cases, business unionism must take part of the blame for refusing to fight and for failing to organize the new non-union sectors. Another clue that racial wage gaps don't pay off for anyone is that the region of the greatest historical segregation and discrimination, the Old South, is also the country's lowest wage region. The average hourly private sector wage in the United States in 1997 was $13.26. Of the 10 Deep South states, only Virginia reached the national average. Georgia came close, but the rest were well over a dollar an hour lower. The white advantage accrued from centuries of racism has never prevented low wages, and never prevented low wages for many white workers, nor employer attacks on white workers' living standards. On the contrary, it weakens the abilities of unions to fight to raise everyone's living standards. As one speaker at a UAW New Directions conference a few years ago put it, racism is the greatest wage reduction program in history. How unions affect inequality. Winning a union contract reduces inequality between the races. In 1979, in the U.S. as a whole, blacks performing the same work as whites earned 10.9% less on average. In the mainly non-union South, this gap was 14%. But in the then highly unionized industrial Midwest, the racial wage gap was less than 1%. Industrial union contracts, alongside equal employment laws, had all but eliminated this particular form of social inequality. The decline of unions in that region since that time, along with concessions and the decay of pattern bargaining, brought the black-white wage gap among workers in the Midwest doing the same work back up to 14% by 1989. Wow. Not coincidentally, everyone's real pay fell during the same period and on into the 1990s. From 1978 to 98, real wages for the population as a whole fell 12%. The lesson should be clear enough. When unions do their job best, everyone benefits more. When they don't, everyone loses. Everyone except the employers. Industrial unionism won equal pay for equal work, but it did not eliminate the wage gap between blacks and whites, or men and women, that results from unequal employment opportunities. Due to past and present discrimination, blacks and Latinos tend to hold different jobs from whites, women different jobs from men. Typically, the jobs held by people of color or women pay less than those held by whites in general, or by white males in particular. In 1997, blacks still made 21% less than whites, and women made 23% less than men on average across the economy. While some unions fought in the 1940s and again in the 60s to lower the barriers of discrimination in hiring, most have stuck to dealing with the problems of current members and left the fight against discrimination to the legislative arena, if they are tackled at all. Despite this failure, union members of all races and both genders make more than non-union workers. Union wage advantage for all workers was about 24% in 1997. White males who belong to unions earned 14% more than those who didn't. And for black males, however, the union wage difference was 29%. For black women was 40%, and for white women, 35%. In other words, at least in the area of wages, union membership is even more advantageous for blacks and women than for white men. So women and people of color have a special stake in making the unions more effective again. That is, a special stake in union democracy and reform. Official efforts to deal with sexism and racism. There's a box here on affirmative action, so I'll read the box. To many whites whose job security is endangered by today's economic conditions, affirmative action seems threatening and unfair. Why don't we just make employment opportunities equal now and forget about the past? Might be one of the more generous attitudes out there today. The problem is that the past won't go away so simply. Since colonial times, both during and after slavery, white males were assumed to have a natural right to the better jobs when there was even a question of competition from people of color or women. This mindset only began to be modified 30 years ago. So ingrained into the fabric of our society is this old setup that most whites thought of it as natural until very recently. Many still do. Yet it took effort to convince people it was natural. New laws had to be passed, institutions constructed to enforce them, the mythology of racial inferiority invented and refined, and jobs classified by race and gender. The undoing of this complex structure and way of thinking will also require effort. After 30 years of equal employment legislation, employment is still unequal. Affirmative action seeks to accelerate a process that would otherwise take decades or more. It's not a program of quotas or of advancing the unqualified, but of giving women and people of color the ability to reach employment levels more or less comparable to their portion of the population or workforce. Seniority is a key principle of unionism. For one thing, it limits employer favoritism. Sometimes, however, it can mask old patterns of discrimination. We gave the example of the separate seniority list for moving into apprenticeships on the railroad that were later merged by union reformers. In other cases, a single seniority list can be a roadblock where one group was the last hired and first fired. Here's seniority that could get them a shot at the better job. Here, women or people of color were denied the chance to accumulate the seniority that would get them a shot at a better job or improve their job security. Affirmative action plans do not eliminate seniority. Rather, they modify the list for a period of time in order to equalize opportunities without giving the employer the ability to play favorites. In the past, some unions and companies were put under court-ordered consent decrees to ensure the hiring and promotion of women or minorities. The best course for union reformers is to get the union to negotiate any affirmative action modification of seniority. This would benefit workers of color or women, but also give the union more control over implementation. In some cases, the best affirmative action policy can be to strengthen seniority. For example, getting into skilled trades apprenticeships in the auto industry now depends on tests which favor formal education over experience and give no value to seniority. if production workers, of whom significant numbers are minorities, get priority for apprenticeships with weight given to seniority, the racial and gender composition of skilled trades would be greatly improved. It cannot be denied that in some cases affirmative action can have a negative impact on some members of the groups who have gained from past discrimination, generally whites and males. In actual fact, however, it's impossible to argue that the current decline in living and working standards being experienced by whites or men as a group have been caused by affirmative action. The evidence for this idea produced by right-wingers and racists is always anecdotal. This white student didn't get admitted, that male worker lost out to a woman, etc. Unfortunately, tough economic times tend to inflame racist ideas and racial conflict. Scapegoat explanations, the blacks, immigrants, welfare mothers, etc., flourish in this atmosphere of economic insecurity. The cause of the declining prospects for good jobs and the lowered standard of living experienced by most working people these days is corporate profit lust, uncontrolled business competition, and right-wing economic and social policies, not the gains of the disadvantaged. Along with countering false explanations, we need to provide the real ones. Okay, official efforts to deal with racism and sexism. Organizations based on ethnicity, race, and gender have a long history in the U.S. labor movement. From the National Colored Labor Union of the 1860s through the Molly Maguires of the 1870s, the Working Women's Union and the Ladies Federal Labor Union of the 1880s, the United Hebrew Trades of the early 1900s, the Negro American Labor Council of the 1950s and early 60s, and many more various groups have seen the need to pull together to further their interests. During World War II and in the 1960s, blacks and Latinos organized inside the unions to force them to deal with the discrimination and gain a greater share of leadership. They were supported by the massive civil rights movements of the times. As black and Latino workers poured into the labor-starved factories of the early 1940s, they demanded equal treatment in hiring and promotions. In 1941, the March on Washington movement, headed by A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, underlined their demands by threatening a mass march of African Americans on the nation's capital just as the country moved toward war. The government issued a Fair Employment Practices Code that was supposed to prevent discrimination in the war plants. In response, some of the new industrial unions set up national and local union Fair Employment Practices Committees. In a like manner, the civil rights movement of the 1960s encouraged the formation of union civil rights committees at all levels. The women's movement in the 60s and 70s produced women's departments and committees in many unions. Equally important, these periods saw the inclusion of anti-discrimination clauses in many contracts. The Fair Employment Practices Committees, Civil Rights and Women's Committees, and departments provided a place for women and workers of color to express their grievances and try to enforce laws and contract clauses prohibiting discrimination. One could probably find thousands of individual cases where they have made a difference. But if we are to judge by overall results, including the slipping employment prospects and real wages of so many black and Latino and women workers, we would have to conclude that their effectiveness has been limited. Writing in the mid-1960s, Ray Marshall, who would later become U.S. Secretary of Labor, characterized the UAW's Fair Employment Practices Department, for example, as ceremonial and symbolic. Racism in the ranks and corporate intransigence explains some of this, but we are also forced to return once again to the fundamental inertia of business unionism. Indeed, in an attack on the shortcomings of the UAW's racial policies in the early 1960s, African-American UAW leader Horace Sheffield contrasted the union's growing business unionism with the crusading spirit of contemporary civil rights activists and the CIO of the 1930s. This inertia isn't just a matter of union maturity or the caution that comes with age. It is a political phenomenon of bureaucracy. Bureaucracy abhors dissent, or conflict. Raising issues of racism or sexism will naturally produce opposition and controversy. Furthermore, the business union bureaucracy often counts on support from the better paid, skilled workers who tend to be white. Confronting racism will challenge these and other political alignments in union politics, forcing leaders to take sides. This kind of politics is anathema to bureaucrats and to business unionism in general. The only kind of racial harmony that comes out of this bureaucratic response is that which unites incumbent officials of all races and both genders in the "now is not the time" line they will hand the aggrieved. A similar problem exists with many of the official and semi-official organizations of women and people of color within the labor movement. The A. Philip Randolph Institute, the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, the Coalition of Labor Union Women, the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance all have an official connection to the AFL-CIO. As Mei Chen and Kent Wong point out, with the exception of the APALA, all these groups were formed on the initiative and control of the AFL-CIO in response to an insurgent population of rank-and-file workers. Others, such as the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists or the Minority Caucus of the Communication Workers of America, were organized independently. Whatever their origins, over time, most of these organizations have become dominated by those possessing or seeking a career in the labor hierarchy. Some local chapters of these groups remain active and effective. Some provide training in organizing and union, basic union skills. As far as fighting for equality, however, the tendency has been for them to become largely ceremonial in nature. Unlike Randolph's Negro American Labor Council in the 50s and 60s, the Trade Union Leadership Council of the same period, or the more militant Black caucuses of the late 60s, today's official and semi-official organizations of women and people of color seldom challenge the status quo. One obvious reason is that most of these groups are themselves dominated by high-level officials with close ties to incumbent white or male officers. Women and people of color are no more immune to bureaucratic functioning and loyalty than the white males who preceded them. The siren cry of high pay, a nice work environment, power breaks with big-name politicians, and all the rest has tamed many a militant. In this situation, official caucuses or organizations of women or people of color can become a way for the bureaucracy as a whole to keep control of union affairs. Caucuses of women and people of color. In the 1960s and early 70s, under the influence of the mass social movements of that time, rank-and-file-based Black caucuses formed in some United Autoworker locals. Very militant against the companies who continued to place Blacks in the worst jobs, these groups argued that union officials had ignored Black workers' concerns and that Black workers needed their own organizations within the unions to press their demands. Today, there are few such rank-and-file, not officially approved, groups. In part, this is because there is little social movement in society to encourage such initiatives. Organizations such as the Black Rank and File Exchange, founded in 1983, Labor Notes Conference, Pride at Work, a national caucus of gay and lesbian union activists, and Latinos United in Labor are current examples of workers organizing against discrimination. Pride at Work began independently and later affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Perhaps one reason there are few unofficial caucuses inside unions today is that women and people of color still run into criticism when they attempt to organize on their own behalf, even when the Women's Conference, for example, is officially sponsored by the International Union. Organizations that promote one group within the union are accused of creating disunity. Isn't this separatism and exclusion, they are asked. Aren't you breaking down solidarity, especially if the meeting or group is not open to all? In truth, such organizations ultimately aid solidarity. They are after equality, and equality is the basis of solidarity and union economic power. The decision to organize a caucus, committee, or movement along lines of race, gender, or sexual preference is up to those who have suffered discrimination, just as the right to organize a rank-and-file reform movement is up to the rank-and-file activists, not the officialdom. We want to take this a step further, however, and argue that organizations based on fighting racial or gender discrimination, where they are not just comfortable parts of the labor establishment, should be viewed as part of the broader union reform movement. For one thing, they will tend to promote a fight with management. For another, fights for equality, just like any other reform cause, tend to open up the politics of the union. They also prepare the basis for broader coalitions in the reform process. Historically, the late 60s and early 70s, when Black and Latino caucuses were forming, was also an era of racially integrated union reform movements, such as the United National Caucus in the UAW, Miners for Democracy, Teamsters United Rank and File, Steelworkers Fight Back, and others that never became formal organizations. The relationship between the different types of rank and file based organizations was often complex and sometimes tense, but the fact was that they all pushed in the direction of greater union democracy and power. Inclusion in reform movements out of the comfort zone. Just as union structures should reflect the membership, so must reform caucuses. Most of the growing and successful reform movements we know of are diverse in terms of race and gender. These organizations have attempted to develop a leadership that reflects the diversity of the membership and to do so from the start. For example, when TDU had its origins among the largely white and male trucking sectors of the union, it always included Blacks and women on its leadership body. Later, as it expanded into the largely Latino food processing industries of the West Coast, Latinos joined as members and leaders locally and nationally. Other reform organizations that have achieved electoral success at one or another level, such as the New Directions Caucus in Transit Workers Union Local 100 in New York City, the Caucus for a Democratic Union in the California State Employees, SEIU Local 1000, or UAW New Directions, have always made a point of developing a diverse leadership. One barrier to equal involvement of workers of color or women is that the whole arena of union politics, including dissident caucuses, can look like the inaccessible domain of white men. If the union hall seems to have the culture of a white male comfort zone, suspicion of union politics will run high among Blacks, Latinos, women, and other left-out groups. This suspicion is mixed with the cynicism most union members of all races have about union politics and politicians. These aren't easy problems, but as we argue throughout the book, a workplace-based approach may be the most effective. The reform group should act around issues such as racial and sexual harassment, unfair contract clauses, or any barrier to equal conditions on the job, as well as workplace problems that affect members across racial, gender, occupational, or departmental lines. Campaigns around improving representation or around contract clauses that affect people often bear positively on race and gender questions as well. For example, say a large local is majority white, but some departments have Black or Latino or women majorities. Winning a new bylaw to require elected stewards will improve representation for all while increasing the chances that the stewards' council and the pool of experienced potential new local leaders is more diverse. To build an inclusive rank-and-file movement, it's crucial that issues of importance to each group receive the attention of the entire group. Newly elected reform leaders, after all, will come under many of the same pressures that led the old guard to ignore the racial or gender injustices, particularly where the majority of union members are white and or male. The emphasis should be on what the group does. Winning a case of sexual harassment or discrimination in promotion, passing a bylaws change that eliminates a barrier to running for office, or getting a paid holiday for Martin Luther King's birthday, rather than passing resolutions, which are the specialty of business unionism. campaigns, coalitions, and election slates. Reform movements seldom grow simply by one organization becoming bigger and bigger. Along the way, new organizations are formed for different purposes, say a contract campaign. Coalitions are struck and a broader base is established. The reform movement in Local 100 of the Transport Workers Union, a 35,000 member union in New York's Transit Authority, New York City, provides a good example. This movement began as a newsletter called Hell on Wheels, put out by a small group with a diverse membership. The group became well known for its campaigns for better contracts, similar to those waged by TDU, Teamsters for a Democratic Union. For the group to have to become a successful challenger to executive board elections, however, it had to form coalitions with other organizations or their leaders. Early in its life, the Hell on Wheels group united with leaders of the Nubian Society, a black fraternal order. A more recent alliance involved a leader of the Emerald Society, an Irish fraternal order. Eventually, an alliance was formed around an election slate called New Directions, which eventually became a unified organization that narrowly lost the 1998 election for top officers. Elections offer a time to build broader coalitions and recruit a more diverse membership to the reform movement. The formation of a representative slate for elections speaks louder than words. It must reflect the union membership to the greatest extent possible. One of the most frequent barriers to accomplishing this is the often unspoken assumption that people only vote for their own kind. Without denying the existence of sexism and racism, it's important to remember that at their best, union politics are different. As TDU leader Ken Pafs put it, the union context tends to bring out the best in people. The union, after all, is one of the few places in society where people of all races work together for common goals. So white male Teamsters will vote heavily for a slate that includes blacks, Latinos, and women, as they did in international elections in 1991 and again in 96. In 1998, the Teamster Reformers put forth the most diverse slate ever run in that union. Tens of thousands of white Teamsters supported the Tom Leadham rank and file power slate. At the DGM assembly plant in Newark, Delaware, in 1997, a majority black and white male workforce elected an Asian woman and New Directions leader as shop chair, a position long held by white men in most auto plants. In Teamster Local 2000, which represents Northwest Airlines flight attendants, the vast majority of them white, an African-American woman and TDU member took the presidency and carried her entire TDU slate to victory. Why? Because these reformers were sane and doing things the rank-and-file majority knew they needed. Union politics had been taken out of the bureaucratic comfort zone and the old divisions were broken down. As so often happens, a struggle around one issue opens people's minds on more questions than one. The majority of members were able to recognize diversity in leadership as a strength, not a weakness, a source of unity, not division. Anyone in the business of changing the status quo needs to remember that when the circumstances call for it and leaders and movements arise to offer an alternative, people will change. People will suppress, overcome, or even abandon their old ideas, prejudices, and suspicions when a genuine alternative shows itself. That's the end of chapter 3.